a taste of Melbourne's diverse poetry scene.
Poets using their voices to entertain, to move, to take you on a journey.
Connecting you to grassroots poetry and performance.
Good morning. Welcome to Spoken Word on 3CR. I'm Tina Janoukas. 3CR broadcasts from the lands of the Wurundjeri. I pay my respects to elders past and present. Today on the show, I have Madeline Dale, whose first collection of poetry, Portraits of Drowning, published by the University of Queensland Press, is the 2025 winner of the prestigious Five Islands Poetry Prize for a first book of poetry. 3CR is a sponsor of the prize. Madeline grew up on Tamborine Mountain in Queensland and now lives in Brisbane. She has a Master's in Creative Writing from the University of Queensland, where she has been completing her PhD. I'm speaking with Madeline on the phone from her home in Brisbane. Welcome, Madeline. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's really lovely to be on.
What does it mean to you to win this prize for a first book of poetry, the Five Islands Poetry Prize?
Oh, it's such a huge validation of the work, I think. Even when you publish and even having a book out there, I think a lot of debut authors and certainly myself are still questioning, is the work good? Is it doing what I want it to do? Has it found its audience? And it's a tremendous honour and a tremendous relief to have an external source sort of be able to say that the book has hit home with someone, at least. So it's been a really comforting thing to happen, I think.
Did it surprise you?
Yes, no, very much so. You always hope, I think, for the best, but it was a huge surprise to be shortlisted and a really big surprise to win as well. I'm aware that the book is perhaps a little strange in some ways. It's perhaps a slightly unusual book of poetry at times, and it's been really lovely that it's gotten a little bit of love from Five Islands.
Do you think this prize affirmed your choices in relation to the book?
Yes, very much so. I'm aware that I'm a poet who writes a lot in persona. I really like to write about historical things, about historical people, about robots and ghosts, things that maybe people don't always associate with the very confessional mode of poetry. So it was very heartening to know that people were connecting with that, and also very encouraging that I might be able to continue in this line of work.
It's an interesting collection because it's in three parts. How did you conceive this collection?
Well, this collection arose out of the research that I was doing for my master's degree, in which I was researching the problem of eco-poetry and how in a world of climate catastrophe and climate change, as writers, as poets, we can actually write about these things in a way that is useful and not didactic or not catastrophizing or not entirely bleak. So the book for me was an attempt to answer that question of how can we write about the present moment without falling into either despair or falling into sort of banner waving sloganeering. Almost every poem is sort of an attempt to answer that in a different way.
Why three parts?
Well, I quite like threes. I think there's a lovely wholeness to threes, but the three parts in this book are sort of structured around three different ways of thinking about environmental catastrophe. The first part is oriented around the idea of damage and about writing honestly and openly about the damages that the world has suffered. The second part is oriented around the idea of learning to love a damaged world and learning to live and live meaningfully in a world where things are often in freefall. And then the final part is structured around what might be grown out of that, what might come next, what strange transformations might occur within this damage and what new things might rise up from it.
Well, let's have a poem from the first part, The Fraser, which I think very much speaks to the ecological. You've got two poems called The Fraser. Let's hear the first one. But would you like to tell us a little bit about these two poems?
Yeah, these are both poems that I wrote after I was in Vancouver and I was coming across the air rail train from the airport and saw all of the logs in the Fraser River that had been brought down by the logging companies and were there waiting to be shipped to their next destination. I find logging abhorrent, but it was such a beautiful image, and this tension of the beauty of it and kind of the terribleness of it really stayed with me. So both of these poems have been sort of an attempt to work through that and metabolize that in some way.
Well, let's hear the first one.
Great. This is the Fraser one. I was thinking of logs in the Fraser River, their bright skins rolling up, up and out of the salmon run, a whole pine lot stripped and turned sideways, slung against the booms like a tapped box of pencils. A jam man goes trunk to trunk, polling out an order. In another imagining, he carries dynamite and the rough drive to use it. Now, fingernails of bark flake into the current and are rushed away like rafts of dead pollen. Upstream, early morning curdles on blue glass. Churches sell their air rights, and the jam man kneels to pray or eat, to press against the dirt and give his sky a better price. I was thinking of wild things and what we make of them.
I find that last line extremely interesting. It gives the poem another dimension altogether.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I was very much thinking about the transition from a wild ecological space to a domesticated space, to a space that we use for materials, what it means to take a wild forest and turn it into chipwood or to turn it into toothpicks, and where we do that more broadly, not just in very material things like trees or mining, but where we do that with species or other places.
What comes first for you? Is it the image or the idea?
For me, it's often the image. I'm a very imagistic person. It's either the image or the feeling, but I often find that a poem that starts in feeling doesn't find its feet until I have an image to attach it to. I can sort of feel very overwhelmed or moved or affected by something, but until I have something concrete to map that feeling onto, I find that the poem doesn't work. Trying to write purely from feeling for me always falls flat, I find.
Yeah, I find what you're saying very interesting, because when I was reading through the collection, I often found the images actually quite intellectual.
I think this might be because I'm sort of a chronic overthinker. I've never been able to look at something and I think appreciate it just for what it is and move on. Everything I turn over or I look at or I find, I'm always trying to ferret out some other meaning or attach some other meaning or say, what does this mean for me? What could this mean for me? Which is very good for a poet, but I think perhaps sometimes frustrating as a travel companion or as a companion on a hike or a walk.
One of the poems that I find devastating in the collection, and I keep returning to it, is the poem again from the first section, The Great Auk. Can you tell us a little bit about what this poem is about, and then let's have listeners hear it?
I love talking about the auks. They were this beautiful species of birds, like a large penguin, almost, and they were incredibly docile. So when sailors first started encountering them, they were incredibly easy to capture and kill. They were very fat rich. They had very soft feathers that were good for down, for pillows. They were good for eating. They were good for boiling down into fat. And you could essentially just pick them up. There are accounts of sailors stopping by the islands where they lived and just gathering these birds in their arms and sort of throwing them directly into the ships. And because they were so docile and so unafraid, they are wiped out really, really quickly. And we have this account of what is believed to be the death of the last auk, I think, in the British Isles.
When did sailors first come across these birds?
That's such a good question. I know that in 1534, there is an account of people filling the boats with them. I don't know if there are early accounts of sailors coming across them that weren't written down, but very early on there are accounts of them being taken up. And then in 1840 is sort of the last recording of an auk in the British Isles.
Well, the poem is devastating in its description of these events. Let's hear the poem.
Certainly. The Great Auk. Mother minced the fish meat, tails of fat froth and flipper, bodies sewn into bolsters, a survivor stoned on the quarterdeck, taken for ill oracle. What kin am I to the endling parents strangled on Eldie Island, to their chick crushed from her egg on a slick of tea-coloured albumen? Father fished easy as a stone, ships gunnel full of limp birds. What is kinship when a flock becomes 100, a dozen, a wet fermata clogged in yolk, a generation turned to light, to tallow smears and soot marks? It is a stone across the neck. It is a cold, cold weight.
Well, I find that devastating.
I hope that people do, because I feel terribly sad about these birds. And I hope that if we are devastated about what's happened to the auk, we can be devastated about what's happening to other species that there still might be a chance to save.
Well, ours, I suppose, might be called an ecological age. But when the great auk was killed, certainly that wasn't the sort of thing that people thought about, was it?
No, not at all. I think the auk is a bird that has been killed for convenience, because there wasn't a sense that we would want to preserve it for its own sake when we could be using it for something that would help us. And I think now we tend to lose species not through convenience but through the impacts of decisions that it is not always clear what the runoff impacts are going to be. You know, we open a new coal mine and somewhere down the line a parrot loses its habitat, and that leads to this slow extinction just as surely. We're not sort of going out there and strangling animals with our bare hands anymore, because we sort of moved on from that form of interaction with them, but there's still this devastating loss going on all around us.
Poms like the Great Auk hold a very strong image. How do you know when an image has done enough in a poem?
I think for me, I am always thinking about when I am satisfied with it. I try not to get too much into the realm of how the poem will land with an audience or whether it will have a tangible impact, which is something that's a real big problem in eco-poetry, is whether or not what we're writing will ever have an impact. So I try to stay within the bounds of what I know as the poet, and when I feel like the image is strong and clear and working, and when I return to it and I still feel something about it, then I say, okay, I think that's working enough for me to send it out into the world, and hopefully it will work on other people as well.
Help 3CR raise funds by donating your containers. Every eligible drink container that you return to a Container Deposit Scheme recycling point earns 10 cents, which can really add up. 3CR is a donation partner for Victoria's Container Deposit Scheme. The scheme allows you to recycle selected aluminium, glass, or plastic containers and donate the funds earned to a not-for-profit organisation of your choice. Help us raise funds for the station. Search for Community Radio and choose 3CR next time you cash in your cans. Go to cdsvic.org.au for more information.
Welcome back. I'm Tina Janoukas. You're listening to Spoken Word on 3CR. Today I'm speaking with Madeline Dale on the phone from Brisbane about her collection Portraits of Drowning, winner of the 2025 Five Islands Prize for Poetry. In the second part of the book, you seem to be exploring the underbelly of human relationships. Would that be a fair comment?
Yeah, I think it starts to move into a more human register and how we interact with each other, how we interact with the non-human world, how our bodies exist in the world.
Let's hear Catch, Limits and Closure from the second part.
Perfect. Catch, Limits and Closures, the Shastradeo. Dad pulls a man up with the cray pots, some antique ice sailor, his bleached hands tangled in our nylon rope, sunblind and stunned under a coronet of sea foam. An abalone diver has caught him with a boat knife, opened a dry gash along one shoulder. Mother of pearl gleams on exposed bone. My father touches the gold hoop, pulling at our ghost's ear, but doesn't unthread it. You're supposed to throw them back, or else lead them to a port office. Most fishermen carry dented plastic bottles of milk now to lure them along. No one minds so much if they're white men. We sit him on the thwart. I knot his wrists. I pull a dozen fish hooks from his side. A little industrial history rattles in my palm, a sound like broken beads. When he speaks, it's with a whipbird's voice, the carol cry that snaps over clear cut, then the hush-hush of marram grass on the coast, the puppy yap of skinned thylacines. They must have known each other, the tigers and the dead man. Fellow snare creatures, friends to the trap. Dad still shoots rabbits in our dairy fields, a dozen shovel funerals each day. He looks at our catch like a man sighting down a rifle and leads the ghost home. I set a saucer of blood by the back door, spoons of salt and marrow to colour a pale mouth or flush on collarbones. The kitchen is an aorta of talk, fish's map of current and undertow. Later, the skin rasp sound of waves forming. In the morning, a thumbnail of gold sits cold on the burner, and the ferry has its back to the Mersey.
Is that a totally imagined poem?
Yes, it's an imagined poem with some grounding in the real world. The Mersey is a river in Tasmania, so this is a poem that's sort of set around the Devonport area where my grandparents lived when I was young. So the abalone divers and the port officers and the marram grass and the thylacines are all kind of part of that Tasmanian ecosystem and ecology. And then, of course, the idea of there being wandering ghosts is very much imagined, a way of sort of making visible the colonial and historical ghosts that are sort of still felt in those areas.
Well, of course, you weave the thylacine into the poem, which is, of course, a destructive effect of colonialism on the Tasmanian environment. It's like the return of the uncanny in the poem, isn't it?
Yeah, I think I was definitely thinking about that idea of what returns. I was thinking a lot about the sailors who left from Hobart to go on expeditions down to the pole when they were still sort of mapping Antarctica and trying to be the first to get to the centre. A lot of those ships left from Hobart, and I was sort of thinking about those kind of lost or dead explorers as another thing that has vanished, perhaps a negative impact on Tasmania as part of that march of colonialism, and what it might be like if they still had a sort of a physical presence in the world.
One of the poems that I find intriguing is the Cupbearer. I don't know if it's meant to be a love poem, but I find it quite intriguing. Would you like to read the poem and tell us about the conception of love that does seem to run through some of the poems?
Yes, I think this is a love poem, despite the fact that it's sort of very interested in wounding and illness, and there's a kind of a sorrow to it. I think the undercurrent of it is very much about loving someone or being loved. This poem is fictitious. It's written in persona, but it has sort of sprung out of reading. At the time, I was reading a lot of historical military accounts and sort of reading about people getting killed on the battlefield and sort of the many horrible ways that one could die in older wars and the conditions of bodies that were left on the field. And so this poem, in a way, was kind of me imagining what it would be like to sort of pluck one of those people out of history and out of battle and out of death and provide them with some form of comfort or recovery, which is something I think about a lot, the kind of the dead of history and the bodies of history. So this poem brings that suffering body back into contemporary time, I suppose, and imagine a healing for it.
Let's hear the poem.
The Cupbearer. That sloughing August, you were like dark spots in vision when blood pressure drops. A cupbearer on a constant path to bring me water, aspirin. Frantic moon in orbit, some days I saw you harvest bright, others like a crescent of memory, gone by morning. When the wounds close, blue pale in new skin, you pulled me from sour sheets through the night sweet house. It had turned early spring. Fireflies swarmed my absence, kindling their signal fires down the tip road as if to fill the space I'd left. We sat on a broken washer. You lit a match and dragged a thumbnail along the seam where my skin had split and stitched, and I was glad to have lived to show you this, the fireflies on a September night.
Of course, it's very hard to imagine the genesis of this poem hearing it.
Yes, I'm aware that I sort of often come to poems in an odd way, one might say. I'm very easily affected by and moved by historical accounts or by fiction or by art or by the world. And I think that I often wrap that sense of being affected into a love poem. If I don't quite know how to make clear my affection for a soldier who has died 200 years ago or for a river or for a bird, I often speak in the terms of a love poem. I think it's more legible, it's perhaps more easily understandable, and it's a way of conveying the things that I do love in perhaps a way that makes more sense to a reader than trying to explain how deeply I feel about bodies that are left on battlefields or things of that nature.
So it's a kind of empathetic response, really, isn't it?
I'd like to hope so. I like to hope that it comes through as empathy and maybe kindles that sense of empathy in a reader, even if its origins aren't always clear or made clear by the poem.
The third part is also very interesting, and there's a poem there that I found quite challenging, actually, to think about, and it's the one called Resuscitation Annie. Would you tell us about that poem and read it for us?
Yes. Resuscitation Annie is about the Annie CPR dolls. If you have learnt CPR at any point in your life, there is a really high chance that you learnt it on an Annie doll. And the Annie dolls all have the same face, and that face is taken from a death mask of a girl who supposedly drowned in the Seine River in Paris. So I think it's just fascinating, this idea that this unknown young girl has died, a death mask has been taken off her face, and now thousands of people have learnt how to save someone from drowning by breathing air back into this mask of this girl's dead face. And I think it's just this fascinating sense of her ghost moving forwards, and even though she was not able to be saved, that she is kind of involved in the saving of so many lives. I think there's something really beautiful about it. And of course, I think there are a lot of undercurrents as well about how we treat women's bodies and girls' bodies, and how beauty and death can be entwined, and how death and art can be entwined.
Let's have the poem.
Resuscitation Annie. How many times can we save this girl? 16 when she went into the Seine, fate lining up the sibilance like that. Too soon for the art of CPR, but not for a boat hook and a newborn wetness on the right bank. Not for the open morgue or the mask maker's grip, finger and thumb dimpling her jaw. Never a moment she isn't kissed. Hesitant mouthing of girls her own age. The rough emergency of instructor EMTs, all of us passing her hand to hand, breath to breath, so well she never wants for air, so well a Paris mortician swears he sees her chest rise. I believe him. I saw her too, an oddity shop in the mountains, a silent mouse in an upstairs shadow, touched a finger to her silicon cheek, parted a hand through her nylon hair, thought, here I am, and here you are. Fate has lined us up. I could still drown. She could still open her eyes. We've held that door open. I believe in all of us, making the chain, learning how to breathe, letting her teach us how to save ourselves.
There's an incredible intimacy in that poem, isn't there?
Yeah, I think so. The first time I came across one of these resuscitation dummies after I knew the story was in an antique shop in the Blue Mountains, and I was alone in this small room with this resuscitation dummy whose face I'd studied so closely previously because I was so interested in the story. And just being in that space with the face of this dead girl and just thinking about the long chain from that girl who drowned in a river in Paris through And I like to think of this long chain of people learning how to save each other or to save ourselves in a way.
I would like us to talk a little bit about the poem in the collection, which draws on the Trojan War, Give Andromache a Knife. I wouldn't call this a feminist collection, Portraits of Drowning, but it certainly is a collection that has an eye to undoing the settled narratives. What was your aim in writing this poem?
I think you've put it really nicely there, this idea of undoing the settled narratives. I was a classics major in my undergraduate days, and I'm very interested in how we see ourselves in these representations of ancient women and the tension between recognising ourselves in these women and recognising the fundamental individuality and perhaps inaccessibility of these women's lives as well. Though we may really see ourselves in a figure like Andromache, so much as there might have been a historical Andromache, she's still quite distant from us. And even as we seek to write a new narrative for these ancient women that we kind of so badly want to free from their old narratives, they are still, in a sense, trapped by that narrativizing. Everything we write about them boxes them in more, in a way. I'm very interested in the tension between those two desires.
Let's hear the poem.
Give Andromache a knife. Let her cut away this story. The red and yellow cloth in the market is not enough. The dead men of her family are not enough. A life of soft-handed spinning by a foreign fire is not a life. Hand the girl a blade, the verse is fat with them. Their high arc and quick fall are the oldest songs we have. She'll know how to do it. Open a seam in the stanza and slip out the belly of blind Homer like a new child. There is a world beyond repetition, outside the mouths of men chewing her misery. Women will leave other records. The dust of Troy is thick with paint and fragment. Even the dirt holds girls in old boots and new maps. Hand down something sharp or serrated, ladies. Let Hector's widow fill a few pails. Let Etienne's orphan walk, red and yellow, off the page.
Thank you, Madeline, and congratulations on winning the Five Islands Prize for a first book of poetry, which is, of course, Portraits of Drowning.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for letting me talk about my favourite extinct bird so much today.
Thank you. I'm Tina Janoukas. You've been listening to Spoken Word on 3CR. Today I've been speaking with Madeline Dale about her first book of poetry, Portraits of Drowning, which won the Five Islands Poetry Prize for a first book of poetry. It's a prize that 3CR sponsors. Madeline's book, Portraits of Drowning, is available online from University of Queensland Press. Spoken Word on 3CR broadcasts every Thursday at 9 a.m. on 855 a.m. Or you can download the podcast. Thank you for listening.